You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, wrapped up in books.
Hello, yes, and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers.
Mena van Praag.
And this is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is crime writer Ruth Dugdall. And we also have interviews with John Greening, who's a poet, and Margie Blunden, who's the daughter of World War I poet Edmund Blunden. And they've collaborated on a new edition of Edmund Blunden's memoirs. We'll be talking to them later. And you went along to Anglia Ruskin University, Mena.
I did. I went to the launch party of their new anthology for the Anglia Ruskin students and editors. And it was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. And some of these writers were being published for the first time.
I think most of them were, in fact. Yeah, and they were very excited.
Yes, yeah, well, it's exciting. And Ruth, just to talk about publishing, being published for the first time. Do you remember that feeling?
Oh, I do remember it. It was an accident for me. I hadn't really thought about publication, but I won a competition through the Winchester Writers Festival, which is a wonderful festival, 15 competitions. I've never been, but I enter the competitions every year, or I used to, and one of them that I won, the prize was a print run. So in effect, it was a self-publishing deal. And it was life-changing. I remember the moment when I got the letter to say I'd won and crying. And it changed everything. I think it stepped everything up. It was that feeling that somebody believed in the book. And of course, self-publishing is a gateway to lots of other things. I attracted an agent through it. So yeah, it's a you have to get your stuff out there if you want to write.
And the difference between self-publishing and being published by an established publishing house, there is some, I'm not denigrating self-publishing at all, but there is something about being validated by an external person.
Oh, there is. But I think the reality is that 0.03% of books submitted to publishers get a deal. It is so incredibly difficult that I don't know how anybody starts out without self-publishing first, or without a competition win in an anthology or something. I actually think it's such an impossibility to get a publishing deal without some kind of pedigree that self-publishing is the way most people should and do start, and I highly recommend it. It teaches you such a lot about self-promotion, and you get skills that you will need when you're published by somebody else.
I have to second that, actually, because I self-published before I was published. And you think that it'll be this huge difference and you get published by Penguin and suddenly they'll do all the promotion, and you're doing it exactly the same as if you're self-published. You're doing it all yourself.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I know so many writers who, when they do achieve that publishing deal, they think the publishing house will do it for them. And actually, it's not true. You still have to be out there just as much as when you self-publish. And some of the self-published authors I meet are better at promoting themselves and networking, that is what you need to do. It's not just about the book, sadly, and has it ever been? I mean, it wasn't for Dickens. Why should it be for us? So,
and I guess it's about learning the trade from the bottom up, really. It's like being the person in the hairdresser who washes the hair and sweeps the floor. You know, if you know how the pieces of how it's put together and how you do it, then when you come to be the stylist, you understand all the components of that job.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you do realise you can't rest on your laurels. You sort of think, oh, the publisher will take over. And you realise quite quickly that that's not the case. And if you've done it yourself first, it gives you a good... Because I was brought kicking and screaming to self-publishing, but it was a really good thing to do.
And Legend Press, who you're with, Ruth, they're a small press, but this is the age of the small press as well.
Oh,
isn't it
totally is. I mean, one thing I would say about small presses and self-publishing is you keep the power much more than with the big commercial houses. And you know, there's something about whether you are Kellogg's or whether you are a small bespoke, you know, are you a craft beer or are you Stella Artois? And actually, there's a place for saying I want to keep my power and I want to be I want to be in control, like a self-published book. And the small presses, you have more say. You can say, look, I really hate that cover. And actually, I'm not happy with that. And I want it. And they're going to listen to you far more than a big machine, which is going to bulldoze ahead with or without you. And also with a small press, when they get openings, like my publisher put me forward for Radio 4. And if I'd have been with a bigger publisher, I don't think they'd have given me that slot. They'd have given it to a book that was really well known. So I think there's a lot to be said for small, independent presses. And that's where the brave stuff is happening. That's where the books are coming out that are making you sit up. You know, there's something a little bit tired about these big publishing houses. They're producing the same kind of stuff. They're producing Kellogg's.
Well, Amir McBride, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, she went to several big publishing houses and none of them would have her. Mm. But, I mean, because it is a very challenging book and it eventually got published by a small press. And, of course, then it went on to win the various awards, you know, Orange and Booker, and it's fabulous.
Yeah. I so love that we're having this conversation. This is really fascinating.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut it short, but I'm cutting it short with Nick Kershaw, which, if you're going to cut anything short, is the way to do it, because this is your first track, Wouldn't It Be Good, by lovely Nick Kershaw. Why have you chosen this one, Ruth?
I wanted a song that said something about my teenage years, which is when most of us form our music tastes, but also because Nick Kershaw's from Ipswich, and that's where I went to school. And this reminds me of school. And actually, school is where I began being a writer. I didn't know it, but it was happening for me then.
Be good if we could live without a care. I got it bad. You don't know how bad I got it. You got it easy. You don't know when you got it good. It's getting harder.
That's Wouldn't It Be Good There, just fading away, by Nick Kershaw, the first choice of music of our studio guest today on Bookmark, Ruth Dugdale. Ruth worked as a social worker and a probation officer before quitting her job to write full-time. Her debut novel, The Woman Before Me, won the Crime Writers Association debut Dagger Award and the 2009 Luke Bittmead Bursary. Her other novels include The Sacrificial Man, The James Version, and published this year, Humber Boy B and The Nowhere Girl. She currently lives in Luxembourg and volunteers at a local prison. She says her books explore the darker areas of human behaviour and how long-held secrets can affect the present. I must admit, Ruth, it did make me smile when she said you live in Luxembourg and volunteer at a local prison. You can't stay away from criminals, can you?
I can't. And actually, when I think about like where I come from and Ipswich, and when I was listening to that song, I was at Chantry High School, and that's a quite a rough area of Ipswich, and I was very unhappy at school, and actually it was hell for a child to be unhappy, but what a blessing for a writer. And because you learn to be the outsider, and the outsider observes. And what I learned from going to that school was about what it's like for people to survive without much money, without perhaps many aspirations. You know, it's a school where people don't think necessarily they're going to go to university. I hope it's changed now. I think it has. But, you know, my friends were from families that were struggling. And that influenced my decision to become a probation officer. Absolutely. And without going to that school, I couldn't have been a probation officer. And without being a probation officer, I couldn't have been a crime writer. I can't bear crime books written by establishment writers who've actually never sat in a room with a criminal. I can't bear it where the criminal is something other lurking in the shadows that must be overcome. Because actually, when you meet somebody who's committed a crime, they are me, they are you, they're but for the grace of God. It's all that stuff. There is always a reason why people make the decisions they make, commit the behaviour they commit. And this is what motivates me. It's what interests me as a writer, but also when I was a probation officer. So yeah, I can't stay away from prisons. I can't stay away from the areas of life that for me are more interesting. I want to see people living on the edges. I want to see the underbelly. So when I was in Luxembourg, which is a very rarefied, very wealthy city, that side of it does not interest me at all. I'm not interested in designer shops and Michelin star restaurants. I am down the Gar area. I am speaking to the refugees. I'm speaking to the prostitutes and the drug users. It's their stories that I want to write about and that I want to discover. And that's something that has really developed right from when I was very young.
And this probation work, I mean, this is heavy duty probation work you were doing. You were in a maximum security prison, sometimes working with children convicted of murder.
That's right. After the Jamie Bulger murder, the British criminal justice system realised they had no way in this country of dealing with children who'd committed grave crimes, murder, rape, manslaughter and arson. So they set up four prisons in the whole of the country to take those cases. The cases that you read about, Child A, Child B, the people aren't named because they're so young. And when I heard that they were opening this prison, and one of them was near Scotland, one near Wales, one near London, one in Suffolk. And my goodness, I wanted that job. I'd already been a probation officer for a few years. I was the least experienced probation officer to apply for that job. But my goodness, was I keen. And I said to them, please, you know, give me this chance and I will give everything to this. And I worked for 2 years in this prison. And we handpicked these boys. We took them from all over the country. They were 14, 15, and they'd murdered and they'd raped. And, you know, you'd read the cases and be totally horrified. And then you'd have this teenager in front of you. And within half an hour, they're telling you a story that is so devastating. And I never didn't hear that story. You know, I don't believe in evil or innate badness because I heard that story too many times. And of course, you're not excusing what these people have done, but you need them to understand it. And that work carries on for me with my writing. I want to understand why people do what they do. That's what my books are all about.
There is a problem, is there not, about writing about children? Because some people will, and there are often children in your stories, either in peril or who are criminals, that some people will say that that's quite manipulative.
Yes.
I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate here, Ruth.
No, one thing that people have said to me is, you know, but what about the victims? What about, because all of my books are based on real cases. And I believe that as a writer, not just as a writer, as a film writer, as an artist, as an actor, no subject should be off limits. I understand that we need to have sensitivity to the people who are affected by those kind of cases. But if we ignore those cases, if we don't work on them creatively, if we don't explore them, then we won't understand them. And my books aren't cannibalistic in the way that some crime books are. I'm not gratuitously violent. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the psychology. But I am very aware that some of the people's books I write, people could read them and say, that's my case, or that's my son's murder I'm reading about. And I realise that, and I hope that if those people ever got in touch with me, I wouldn't feel ashamed and that I would be able to explain my decisions. So I try to have integrity, but I would always defend the right of a writer or to explore those areas. We need to. It's human behaviour.
Right, there's plenty to talk about, isn't there? Yeah. We're going to drill down into some of those books in detail in just a moment, but we'll go to this report that you did, Manna.
Yes, I went to celebrate the Mint Anthology release by the Anglia Ruskin students at the lovely 12A Club on Market Square, and it was lovely to meet them all.
So if you just start by telling me your name and the title of your story.
I'm Sue Dean, and the title of my story was The Dead Don't Care.
I want you to tell me a bit about what you've learnt on the MA course.
How to write better, I suppose. How to be more concise. I write short stories. I'm not writing a novel. I like to write short pieces.
So how much writing did you do before you started the MA? Do you have?
I wrote in my 30s, but I'm now in my 60s, and I had a long gap when I didn't do anything at all. And I haven't really written anything until I started the MA after a gap of 30 years.
So what inspired you to want to do it?
Just wanting to learn something. I just wanted something that was not work to go to. And I've had 4 short stories published since I've done it.
And how did you find the other aspects of the course?
I did the novel and I did genre writing. That was great fun, genre writing. The novel, not such fun.
You don't like things so long. You like to keep them short.
No. A novel requires you to be very sustained in your writing.
Do you feel that you could have written the story that you wrote for this anthology before doing the course?
No. What it did was spur me to write. So probably if I hadn't have done the MA, I wouldn't have written. I need someone or something to write for.
Would you recommend others to do this course?
Oh, yes. It's huge fun. Huge fun. And Anglia Ruskin is a great place to do it.
My name's Alex Rouget, and my story is Starting Over. It's very short. It's the shortest story I think I've ever written, although it did take me a long time to write. It's about a woman who falls in love with a baker. They're very much in love, very, very quickly, and then he just leaves her very suddenly, and she's very upset. But he leaves behind his starter dough, and then one night she drinks the starter dough, and it's what happens to her and what she turns into. But I won't give away the ending. I always wanted to write a story that was taking a reader on a really surreal journey and seeing if I could do it in an authentic way. I sort of wanted to set myself that challenge. So at the beginning of the year, I started to write it, and I love that story by Jackie Kay called Shell, where she turns into a tortoise. And I know it's a metaphor, but it's also just incredible the way that you can just go with it and accept it. And I just had this idea, you know, sometimes when you eat too much bread, you kind of just feel like you are really a little bit turning into bread. And so that's where it came from.
So you've done the MA. Could you tell us a little bit about how you found that to be?
I really enjoyed doing the MA. I mean, it was that kind of stage when I was writing and I was just sort of writing fragments. And so what happened with the MA was it made me finish things. It made me become more disciplined, to write more often, to write in a structured way, to have my work read by other people, by tutors, get feedback. And just that validation, saying I'm a student of writing, I am writing, that just makes such a massive difference. And even now, I miss that label I could have, which made me more confident, I suppose, to write more, and the discipline of handing stuff in. And also, I love the analytical side. I love the essays and just really thinking about who I wanted to write like and why their writing worked and what it was about their writing that I enjoyed.
Do you feel that you could have written the story that you wrote before the course?
No, probably not, because you just do grow in confidence and you let yourself try new things and experiment more, I think. I am a completely different writer through doing that course. It's not necessary to do an MA, but to do some kind of course where you share your work, you have to do writing regularly, I think is something that could change you as a writer.
Well, I'm Mike Gibbous, and I'm one of the committee team behind Mint.
Can you tell me why you did this?
Well, I'm midway through my MA in creative writing, and Laura Dietz put out the call for current students to try and get an anthology together. So I just became part of the team that put their names forward to volunteer.
So what have you learned from doing this?
That it's a lot more work than any of us thought. When we started it out, we thought, yeah, we felt a bit cocky. We could do this with a few meetings and send a few emails out. But we got into a good pattern of regular, weekly, two-hour meetings and lots of debate, lots of arguments. We had nearly 100 submissions, and we've read every single one more than once and then debated everything. We're passionate about the stories, and some of the stories sailed through, some of the stories just rose to the top. Some of them we argued pros and cons, and some of us were very passionate about certain stories and wanted them to be in there, and other people less so. We had a good adult comprehensive argument and debate about everything, and I think we got a really good lineup in the end. It was exciting and interesting as well.
What's your ambition for the book?
I'd like it to be a really good stepping stone for it to be a regular event, so that every year we start getting it bigger, we print more each year, and we do get more of these fantastic authors' voices out there. Just give somebody a platform. It's so difficult in this day and age to get printed and to get out there.
I'm Kate Hurst. I'm one of the editors of Mint, and I'm also one of the authors. It's wonderful to be in the book, but it was quite a complicated selection process to make sure that those of us who were involved in it were also fairly judged with the other writers as well. So it was all blind, and then the published author and the academics judged our work separately as well. So double trouble, really.
So tell me the title of your story.
The story is Help Me. It had its genesis on the MA course and through personal experience. So there was a parrot living loose where I live, living wild, which wolf whistled and made odd noises. People started reacting to it, and that gave me the idea of putting a parrot in a story where its speech is part of what turns the story and makes the events happen.
Why did you become an editor on this anthology?
I think it's very hard to get published, so it's a great way to get new writers out there somewhere and get their work looked at and get it published. And we've got it into local bookshops, we're sending it off for review, we're hoping some of the writers at least will pick up interest from agents perhaps or from publishers, and also to do it again next year so that it becomes something that's got some heft that people hear about and know about and it's worth contributing to.
My name's Keith Davies and the title is Lying Blaze of Gorda, which translates to the Fat Englishman. The story is set in southern Spain. It's a story, I guess, about the past and our inabilities to communicate with each other. And the title character is referred to as the Fat Englishwoman in Spanish by Spaniards to distinguish her from the other Englishwoman living in the area. It's written in English, but it's written in a syntax which hopefully suggests use of the English, the Spanish language. Hopefully, it's actually by the end quite poignant.
And so what else have you learned from being on the course?
I think one of the things was coming back to short stories, because actually I hadn't written short stories for years. My interest was actually in novels, and I'd written two novels that had come very close to being published. So I came back to this to kind of kickstart my writing, having moved away from it. Doing the short story module was great. It kickstarted my interest in that. I wrote three or four short stories, one of which is in the book. It enabled me to look far more critically at what I've written, and I think my writing going forward will be stronger than that, for that. It also gave me the confidence to start working on something that I've had an ambition to write for a long time, but always believed was too big and I would never be able to do it.
So you're working on a novel now?
I grew up in Africa, so I wanted to write a book about Africa, which would be fiction, which would be stories, but would tell people what Africa is really like in different ways. So I wanted it to cover big issues like race and race relations and trade imbalances and world politics, and at the same time bring it down stories of individual people.
So it sounds like the MA has given you a real boost.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was absolutely brilliant. I'd wanted to do an MA in creative writing for about 10 or 15 years. At the time, just hadn't seemed right, or the opportunity hadn't been there or whatever. And then I was at a certain place in my life and thinking, yeah, I need to get back to the writing. It was a brilliant experience. I was doing it part-time, so it lasted 2 years. I could have done it for another three or four quite happily.
You must be chuffed a bit to be in the anthology.
Absolutely chuffed a bit. Yeah, it's quite magical. It's great.
My name's Angela Jameson, and the story that I've contributed to the IOU anthology is called Vertigo. It's a flash fiction piece, so very, very quick to read. Longer than a poem, perhaps, and shorter than a short story.
I think some people will think that that's easy to do, but actually it's really hard. I always find the shorter it is, the harder it is.
It is hard. Every single word counts. I really like to say things on the paper in as few words as you possibly can. Of course, there's an attention span issue. People like to escape for a small amount of time, or like on a bus journey, and they will give a certain amount of their time over to escape them. So I think there's a place for flash fiction. The story that I wrote was a love story based on how when you fall in love and you want to express your emotions, that you don't necessarily know how best to express your emotions. And the smallest fear, the smallest panic attack can set you back. And when I'd written it, and when I'd really boiled it down to 300 words, I thought actually it's just about the writer's dilemma. In my story, a woman's kiss transports the narrator into a place where he's like, he's convinced of his love and he wants to shout his love from the rooftops. For a writer, when you have an idea, or when you have that kiss of inspiration, you really want to get it down on paper, but it takes so long to drag that out and put it down on paper in a way that you're happy with. It's really brought out quite a lot of exciting things just doing the MA, because I always wanted to write, but I just didn't know what to do with it. So.
And so why did you choose Anglia Ruskin?
I wanted to experiment a little bit, and it also offered a really good network of local writers and a lot of different subject areas to play with. It's a very, very flexible course, so I'm really enjoying that. I have a better idea now of how to carry on with my writing. Yeah, it's been really great.
That's Angela Jameson there finishing that report. That sounded a good party. That was the launch of the Mint Anthology, Anglia Ruskin University. That Mint Anthology is available in Heppers and Waterstones as well. There was a lot in that report, Ruth Dugdale, there. I was particularly interested in people talking about how sharing their writing changes their writing.
I absolutely. I mean, I thought there was lots that the people who were on the MA said that actually applies to any kind of mentorship scheme you do. I mean, I didn't do an MA, but I did do the escalator scheme for a year and apprenticeships in fiction for a year. And actually, the thing about sharing work is absolutely essential and getting peer feedback. Of course, you need to be wise about that and choose your groups, choose who you share with, because not everybody is going to like what you do. But I think also somebody was saying about the validation, that the fact that they were able to say, I'm a student of creative writing, and they felt validated. And I think that's very important for a writer, to feel able to say, you know, it's like, you know, I'm Ruth and I'm an alcoholic. I am a writer. You know, you should be able to say it. But actually, it takes years, I think, to get to that point. And for all of those students, they will have had a tutor or a mentor figure. And I think having somebody who's further down the line than you, but who's championing you, is really essential. It's certainly something that moved me on.
Who was your mentor then?
Well, when I did The Escalator, it was Michelle Spring, who lives here in Cambridge, and she's a crime writer. And I also had Laura Wilson, who's also a crime writer, and she writes for The Guardian, when I worked was on apprenticeships in fiction. And both of those schemes people can apply for, and they can get Arts Council funding. I got Arts Council funding for both schemes. They were a year each. And, you know, they were both at times when I was facing rejections, like every writer deals with, and I would have gone under the duvet and not come out. And actually having somebody saying, this is part of the process, you just have to dust yourself off, it will happen. Just hearing that is what you need. And for every one of those students being accepted onto the course, then getting the essays back and the pass marks, that's a constant revalidation of that. And we all need to find it in our own way. A local writers group can do it too, just as well, actually. But every writer needs that. I don't think you can be a writer on an island. I think that'd be incredibly hard.
Quite nice then. To
yes.
Well, we'll go to your second piece of music now, which is, I love this track, The Blue Tones and Slight Return. Why this one?
1996, I met Andrew, and about 2 weeks into meeting him, he said, would you like to come and see The Blue Tones with me? I went to Woolworths because I hadn't heard of The Blue Tones and said, can you play it? They put the CD on and I listened to it endlessly before the concert. At the concert, Andrew said to me, wow, you know all the words. So it's that moment.
Where did you go?
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations rather than boasts.
Yes, and on this week's Bookmark, our studio guest is crime writer Ruth Dugdale. Ruth, looking at your books and the subject matter of all your novels, you're not afraid of getting your hands dirty, are you? There are some pretty dark subjects in there.
Yeah, I've dealt with infanticide, with cannibalism, with assisted suicide, and with kidnapping. So, yeah, I am. And interestingly, I mean, we talked earlier about being with a mainstream publisher, and I've been fairly close at times to being signed by mainstream publishers. And what they say is, but she needs to tone it down.
Really?
And and there's this sense that, you know, in fact, one publisher said, well, Ruth's a great writer, but she needs to get this dark stuff out of her system. And actually, that dark stuff's in my system. And I don't want to tone it down. I am interested in the more bizarre aspects of human behaviour and the more extreme, I suppose. But that's that's just something that interests me. I blame my mum. She's a northern woman who loves talking about the neighbours, but it's never the good stuff. It'll never be, so-and-so's just had a lovely holiday in Mallorca. It'll be, did you know that so-and-so's wife left him? And you know that she's ill, don't you? You know, and you know what happened last month? I was brought up with this dialogue of...
She sounds great.
Yes. Yeah, we like... And, you know, she herself, she was a nurse and she worked with physical difficulties. That was her specialism. And so we've always chosen the darker sides or the more interesting parts of life when we're not naturally interested in sunny things.
I so love that you say that because all these things are coming together for me. Because I have a bigger publisher in America and they always want me to lighten everything and take out the dark stuff. And I have a much smaller publisher, lovely publisher, Alison and Busby here. And my editors always say, make it darker.
But there's so much dark stuff out there. Why are they telling you to lighten it?
People say this. People say, but there's dark stuff out there. Yes, but is there? Because if you look at the dark stuff that's out there, what it will have is the dark person, the evil person, will be in the shadows, will be not us, will be somebody to be discovered. And in the end, there will be a nice redemptive ending that ties up all the loose ends. Mm. So people say, but there's lots of dark stuff. And I would say it's not dark when you're neatening it up with a pretty bow. And that's the thing that I've had, you know, you must have a redemptive ending. And actually it's like, but people don't always get redemptive endings. And shouldn't literature reflect our lives? You know, isn't that what we want, actually? Isn't that what we turn to art for? I do. If I'm feeling depressed, I want to read a book about depression. If I'm experiencing grief, I want to see that in the books I'm reading. And so I think it's a cop-out. And I have to say, I think the American publishers or the films are the worst. They sanitize things. And, you know, we have to all be... It's like in Luxembourg, one of my British friends said when we were having coffee once, oh no, the Americans are coming. We have to look happy. You know, and it's that idea that we have to be happy. And, you know, we can be happy, but let's explore what's going on as well and not be afraid of that.
Well, you're not afraid of writing from the point of view of the criminal, really, are you? And often these criminals are female, if not always. And do you think there is an issue there about the bad woman?
Yes, this is something I feel very strongly about. I mean, it happened... I'm a feminist, and I think that feminism is accepting that women also do bad things. And as somebody who's worked for, you know, 20 years with criminals, female criminals are treated differently and they're invisible. And we have this view that if a woman's involved in a crime, she has to be under the influence of the male. She can't have acted of her own volition. And I think, again, that's a cop out. I don't believe it. It's not something that's backed up anecdotally by the things that I've heard, but it's not represented in the statistics. So I'm particularly interested in looking at the female criminal. Because I think, even recently, you know, you can think about high profile murders when there's a male and female acting together. The female will be treated differently. She'll have a lighter sentence. And it will be all about how rough her childhood was and how terrible her life story is, whereas with the male, it will be, well, but he's just bad. And for me, that's very unsatisfying. So I often write about the female criminal brain, and I don't just want to label them as mentally ill, which has been done a lot in crime drama and crime writing too. So yes, it is a hobby horse of mine.
No, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. Well, we are going to shift gear, so there's no way of linking from that to World War One poetry, so other than saying we are shifting gear. John Greening is a playwright and poet. He has written several collections of poems, including To the War Poets in 2013. Perhaps no surprise then that he was asked by Oxford University Press to edit Undertones of War, the memoir of World War One poet Edmund Blunden, first published in 1928. Blunden's daughter Margie was able to help John with his research into the life and writings of her late father. Both John and Margie came into the Cambridge 105 studio to talk about the new edition, and I asked John to tell me a little more about Edmund Blunden.
Well, he was one of the youngest of the war poets and went straight from his beloved school, Christ's Hospital, and really found his voice when he was fighting. But he was a pastoral poet, and you imagine being a pastoral poet for whom the English countryside is so important, and then to go out to the Western Front and see all those things that you love about nature destroyed before your eyes. What do you do as that kind of poet? So he had to find a way of writing which was faithful to that beloved pastoral style that he liked, that would express the horror that he was undergoing in the battles of the First World War. And he was at all the major battles of the war, really.
And he was very prolific during that time, and indeed wrote a lot about it afterwards, but it's not quite maybe so well known as Rupert Brooke or Siegfried Sassoon. Why do you think that is?
Probably is a more difficult poet. Perhaps he never wrote an equivalent of Dulce et Decorum Est, which caught the popular ear. I don't know, maybe there is something about the style. He does stick to this slightly old-fashioned way of writing, which is glorious once you familiarise yourself with it, but it can sound a little bit out of key with our times if you're not used to it. You have to just adapt your ear to his way of writing, and once you do, you're hooked.
And Margie, we're talking about Edmund Blunderney, who was your father. At what stage did you realise that he was a poet?
Quite young. I mean, he was a professor of English at the Hong Kong University when I was growing up, and so there were always students and there were always talks about literature, people coming to the house, visitors to Hong Kong who would come and talk to my dad about all sorts of literary things. So there was that atmosphere that I grew up in, and of course he was a man who was very much in demand from a literary point of view. It was just part of the fabric of living, really.
And John has edited his memoir, Under Tones of War. How important is it to you that the memoir stays refreshed, as it were?
What John has done, I think, has produced a definitive edition of my father's work, because he's put all sorts of elements together and extremely helpful notes. And to me, it's incredibly important that this has happened, because he's also added in illustrations, photographs, and my father had that in mind in 1935 when he got together a book with photos that he'd collected and illustrations that he saw could be put together in an edition of Undertones of War. And now John's done it only 80 years later or whatever. Pretty long lead-in, isn't it? But nonetheless, it's happened, and that's absolutely wonderful in my view.
And do you hear your father in the book when you read it?
I do. What's great for me is that I hear the young man, because, of course, I never knew him as a young man. He was 50 when I was born, and so I only knew him as an older man. And I can hear the young voice, but I can also hear the way he used to speak almost, because he was the kind of man who drew people to him. He had a very quiet charisma, and you would just want to sit and listen to the way he spoke. It was just marvellous and so beautifully put together.
The definitive edition, Margie's described that as. That's praise indeed. What do you, as an editor, actually do when you're editing a memoir? Because you can't change the words, sure.
Apart from panicking at the thought of undertaking this project. I mean, this book has been in print since 1928. It's never been out of print, which is extraordinary. What we wanted to do was go back to his first version of the book, which hasn't been available for a long time. So that's one of the things. So it was a case of taking out what he later put in and perhaps blurred things a little bit. We wanted to have those illustrations, wanted an index. We wanted also something to help people navigate their way around the book. It was written without any notes, without access to his diaries or anything like that when he was in Japan. And so there's a rather dreamlike quality to the writing. And chronology as withers away, as he put it at one point. So it's not always easy to know where you are. And these days we want to know, well, what battlefield was that? Where was he at that point? So I've given headings to the pages and references and things like that to guide people along the way. And there's a chronology. And we've also put lots of extra material in a war diary and poems. He had this supplement of poems at the back. We wanted to expand that. So all those things, but the notes and extracts from other writings, because this was 1928. He lived till 1974, went on writing about the war. As Margie will tell you, he was obsessed with the war. It dominated his life. And so he kept writing about it. Those things he wrote about it, I wanted them to be in the book as well. His comments on what he wrote, and annotations. He made innumerable annotations for his friends in the battalion. He wanted to give them copies of the book, and he would often write marvellous, marvellous annotations. And some of those are in the notes, and some of them are reproduced in the book.
As John says, Margie, the First World War did dominate his life, didn't it?
It certainly did. And I was growing up, I was a witness to how that war had affected him. He called it that war had a long finger, and indeed it did, because he clearly was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which in his day nobody sort of recognised or had any treatment for. But gradually, as he got older and his creative defences started to decline, so the war got much more of a hold on him. And I think that was something that I witnessed as a child growing up very much. As John says, obsessed, I don't know about that. I think the war was in him and he couldn't get it out, even though through all the writing, I think he was trying to somehow expurgate it. He just couldn't do that because he was in it for nearly 2 years and he went through the very big battles. And some of the things that Undertones of War describes, well, you can hardly imagine it even though you read about it. He went on writing about it, I think, to tell us the truth about that war and to stay faithful to the friends who died.
Well, I suppose at least you knew, because lots of men came back and they didn't talk about it, did they? At least you knew what he'd seen and why he was the way he was.
What he talked about were the men, his friends, and the places. So although I was growing up in Hong Kong on the edge of China, by the age of 11, I knew all these places I'd never been to. You know, the place names, Betun, Ypres, Passchendaele. Those places were really, obviously, very significant to him.
So it must be a very precious book for you.
It's very precious. It is him.
How often do you read it?
Can't read it that often because it is painful. For me, it's painful. Obviously, war has many, many aspects, which my father describes in the book. But to read about what he went through is quite a searing experience.
It is a challenging book, John, isn't it? Was it challenging to edit?
Yes, it was. I did feel the responsibility because it is such a well-loved book. Yes, it preoccupied me for several years and I didn't want to mess it up, really. So I'm pleased with the way it turned out and I'm even more pleased that Margie's pleased. You do hear his voice. In fact, if you are reading Undertones of War and having trouble with it, just slow down, read it aloud. That's the way to get into it. And then suddenly it's as if you're with him and he's talking to you and all the strange archaisms drop away and you're in the company of a man who had an extraordinary experience and is writing about it with a deep sense of poetry. He was a poet, but this is prose of the finest kind, really.
In addition to that, John, the most amazing thing is the fact that he survived. Right. It is a story of survival.
Almost every page. Mm. Bomb exploded to my left, but I was unhurt. Yes. Or shrapnel zipped past me, but it didn't touch me. Again and again, he cheats death. Mm. Quite extraordinary. Maybe it was because he was small and nimble and his nickname was Rabbit because he was so nimble, maybe. Or, I don't know, just he was lucky. The last chapter of the book is called My Luck. So he was aware of that luck.
Mm. So the First World War must have dominated your life quite a lot, Margie.
It did. It did, and it's one of those very strange things. It's almost like an inherited thing. He didn't really even have to talk about it at times. It just sort of finds its way into you. It became very much the backdrop of our lives growing up because I had three sisters as well and we were all very, very aware of it.
Working with John on this book, is it almost like completing a circle or putting a line under something?
It is like completing a circle, absolutely, and you've put it very well.
And John, it must have been great to have Margie with you working on this.
Well, it was extraordinary. It was good fortune that Margie only lives in Hunstanton and I'm not far from there. So I was able to go and visit and look through the archive, talk about how we were going to approach this. You know, I wanted to get so much in. I didn't get everything in. There could be more illustrations, perhaps, but you can't have everything. So it was a wonderful sense of being in touch with the man.
You must know the memoir very well now. I've been through every word and every page. Did you discover depths to it and things that you hadn't recognised before?
There are not many books you can read so many times and not be bored. It just got richer and richer. Not a superficial read, although it's an engrossing read and a very moving read. I'd recommend it to anyone. Yes, I love the book. I love it dearly.
And Margie, I know you say you can't read it very often for obvious reasons, but when you do you discover different things in it?
I do. It's like an archaeological dig, really. You know, you've got the top layer and then you go down another layer and another layer and another layer, and every time there's something else in it. And the language is what I love so much, that he has such a way of writing, but it's also really conveys the spirit of the men and how they managed to get through it with humour and love.
Yeah.
This conflict, however awful it was, it had the capacity to bring out people's better selves. It is a book about love, really, I think.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. It's interesting what Margie says about humour. There is that a strong thread of dark humour. There's one moment in the book where one of the officers, as it comes down to look at the battlefield, a shell goes off near him, and I think the line that the battle puts is, he saw, he went, brackets, nimbly, close bracket. That's a little witty jibe. Yeah. It's so typical the way he writes. It's a very witty book.
It is. And he was a witty man. We just used to sit at the dinner table, you know, and he'd just have this wonderful, dry, witty humour, which I think, you know, for somebody who'd been through all that was extraordinary, really, that he managed to salvage his sanity and create a life for himself that was so rich and rewarding.
And how do you feel he would feel now about knowing the two of you were working on this?
I think he'd be delighted, and I think he'd be very pleased that the illustrations got into the edition and the poetry. And John has managed to put in lots more poems, which I'm absolutely thrilled with, because there are several there that are not so well known, John, and you've chosen, I think, very, very well and introduced the public to some different material.
That's John Greening there and Margie Blunden. Pleasure talking to them. John's edited Edmund Blunden's memoir, Undertones of War, which is available from Oxford University Press. You're listening to that, Ruth Dugdale. I was quite interested. Undertones of War is an uncomfortable read, but compelling. An uncomfortable but compelling, words that have been applied to your writing as well. Is that the kind of feeling that you're aiming for in your reader?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think there's, just listening to that, there's something very powerful about writing within a difficult situation. And one of the things that, before I wrote my own novels, I used to do was to, when I was working in the prison, to encourage the prisoners to write and to use their creativity as a therapy, which is something that touches on what we were hearing. Writing can be a good way of dealing with things you don't understand. And, I mean, it reminds me, just yesterday, I was in a discussion about doing creative writing workshops with some of the Syrian refugees who are coming to Suffolk. You know, it's the way you can cope with things you don't understand. And so for me, that's also why I'm writing. I'm not writing about war zones, or if they are war zones, they're personal war zones. Certainly, a lot of the people that I've worked with have had post-traumatic stress disorder. And I've got terrible stories of loss and bereavement. And it is that idea that you can work through stuff with words, with creatively, to cope with them. And also I was interested in that idea that people are obsessed, that you get hooked and obsessed on a certain idea or certain themes. And I think that's also something I like in writers that I enjoy. I like it when people are authentic and exploring things deeply.
And I know you still use a lot of what you learnt and what you experienced when you were a probation worker. How much can you use? You know, how comfortable is that for you?
It's natural to me that I use what's going on around me. So it has to be very, I suppose not necessarily current. Humber Boy B was about a 10-year-old who throws his best friend off the Humber Bridge in Hull. And clearly that was inspired by cases I was working on in the prison. So that was... going into directly into the work I did with those boys and pulling on those cases. More recently, my Luxembourg book, Nowhere Girl, is about refugees, and it's about a girl going missing in Luxembourg. And that was inspired by reality, because at this local school, we were being told, don't let your kids come to school unaccompanied. There have been kidnapping attempts here in Luxembourg. And so then I took that next step to what if a child was taken here, and what would happen? And so, yeah, I do always pull on what's going on around me, because that feels like, for me, the most authentic way to work. And that's something that I hope my novels are always authentic.
They certainly are. We're coming to the end, sadly, but just briefly, what are you working on at the moment?
Ah, well, I have a book that's currently on submission, and it's about an anorexic teenager, and it's also a crime book, and it's the crime she tried to solve that actually caused her to self-starve. So it's that's on submission. Who knows if that will be picked up or not. And I'm also working on another Kate Austin book. My probation officer comes back to...
Haven't talked about Kate at all. I know she was on my list of questions to ask. Tell us briefly about Kate, because she's a fascinating character.
Well, she's a probation officer who works through my book on all these cases. And when I first wrote Kate's story and The Woman Before Me, publishers said people won't be interested in probation officers because they don't know about them. And I refused to change her to become a police officer or a journalist, which was what the publishers were suggesting, because I think probation officers do a really important job, and they are the unsung heroes of the criminal justice system. Plus, they know criminals better than any other profession. They have more face-to-face contact than any other profession. And so she's grown with me. Her personal life unravels and dissembles alongside mine, I suppose. But yeah, she'll have her next case, and we're just starting to work on that now.
Oh, well, high five for probation officers everywhere.
Yes.
Thank you ever so much, Ruth, for being a guest on the show.
My pleasure.
In our next show, our studio guest is former Home Secretary Charles Clarke. He'll be here talking about his latest book, The Too Difficult Box, The Big Issues Politicians Can't Crack, and we'll try and wheedle some secrets out of him as well. We've also got interviews with authors involved with an anthology of short stories written as a tribute to the late Terry Pratchett. And you've got an interview with...
Pilar Alessandra, who I met at the London Screenwriters Festival. That was a lot of fun.
And she is a screenwriter herself?
She's not. She's a mentor and a teacher, but she knows probably more about film and screenwriting than most.
than most. OK, well, we'll sign out with your last choice, Ruth, which is, it's not the version you wanted. You wanted the orchestral version of Better Than Love by Hertz, which, having heard it, I can understand why. So sorry about that. But this is the radio edit version. But why have you chosen this?
Every time I'm writing a book, I have a soundtrack, a song that I play in the background. And this was the soundtrack to The Sacrificial Man. And I just love the story this song tells, and it really says something about the themes I'm interested into.
Every second is a lifetime, and every minute more brings you closer to God, and you see nothing but the red lights. You let your body burn like never before, and it feels